5:04 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time, Tuesday, October 17, 1989. The earthquake struck the San Francisco Bay Area. It was the start of the World Series, and they were ready to throw out the first pitch at Candlestick Park. But as the earth shook, the steel girders in the stands began to shake, and there were pieces of concrete that actually broke off and fell. It was a frightening moment, but initially at least a brief moment. When Candlestick Park stopped shaking, someone came over the public address system and asked that in orderly fashion, everyone immediately evacuate the park. But there were people who were unhappy because they had come to see the World Series, and so they argued back and shouted out, "Play ball! Play ball!" I mean, they were shouting all over the stadium, "Let's get on with this thing, play ball." And of course, they didn't realize what was happening. Across town in the Marina District, where houses built a long time ago, many of them in areas with fill, were actually crumbling and falling apart. They didn't know across the bay on Interstate 880 in Oakland that the bridge had collapsed and had taken lives with it. They didn't know that within just a moment's time, millions and millions and millions of dollars worth of damage was done. 5:05 p.m., a minute later, life was changed, dramatically altered by an earthquake in ways so that life would never again be the same. Now, geologists had predicted that an earthquake would come, although they didn't know exactly when, nor is it possible for them, even in retrospect, to say exactly what has happened. There were, you know, some people better prepared than others because there are, in areas of California and other earthquake zones, what are called earthquake-proof buildings. Of course, the ultimate test of a major earthquake has never been applied to fully know whether they really are that, but other people were totally unprepared, taken totally by surprise. And the people there discovered that simply saying, "play ball," does not make everything in cataclysmic forces and damage done reverse. Change is an unavoidable part of life. And in some ways, that's very good, because if we didn't have change, life would be terribly boring. We wouldn't have the change of seasons. Everything would be absolutely routine. And we would be extremely hungry for change to happen. So we take delight in a variety of foods and in changing experiences and all of those good changes that can come. But we have sometimes great dismay over the bad changes that come. The deteriorating health, or the social upheaval that happens in society, or intrusions when someone, perhaps a burglar or an assailant, enters into our lives and experience and changes them horribly and unexpectedly and permanently. We don't like it when people come into our comfort zones and inflict upon us changes that we would simply not choose. Sometimes we react very, very strongly to the changes that are going on around us and that are within us. We dislike them. Perhaps we try to ignore them. Sometimes we fight back with everything that we've got. And in other instances, we or other people simply accept those changes and say, "Well, that's the way it is, and I guess I've got to accept the status quo, no matter how intolerable it may seem." There was, long ago, an ancient Greek philosopher named Heraclitus. It was he and Parmenides in the debates of ancient Greek philosophy who considered what is the very essence of human experience and what makes the world the way it is. Heraclitus said that the essence of everything is change. It is, in a sense, the only constant. He pictured it in two ways. Heraclitus said, if you want to see what is the essence of human experience and, in fact, of all the world, watch a fire. For not even 2 seconds in a row is it the same. It is constantly changing. That is what fire is all about. Or Heraclitus would say, step into a river. Now step back out. Now step back in again. And it's a different river. For enough water has traveled by and enough changes have taken place that you can never step into the same river twice, because change, flux, is at the central essence to what life and reality are all about. Since change is universal, inevitable, irresistible. Let's consider some more characteristics of it. Change, by definition, is, we usually don't define change. It's something that we understand so very well that usually a definition really isn't necessary. But language historians tell us that in our English language, the word change and exchange have the same roots. In fact, in all probability, once were essentially the same word. So that change really is an exchange. The dictionary definition of change is to alter by substituting one thing for something else. And when you think about it, that's pretty much what change is. So that you have poor health and you get good health, or you have good health and you get poor health. Or you have one job and you exchange it for another job, or you exchange one day, Sunday, for Monday, the next day to come. Or you exchange things that are very good in life for things that are very bad in life. But in every case, it's a change, just like a change of clothing where we take old clothes off and we put new clothes on. Or if I change places with you, that chair then exchanges who is sitting in it. It's the same type of thing every time around, that change is always exchange. But that means then that to get the new, like it or not, we always have to give up the old. There always has to be a trade-in. There always has to be an exchange. Now, that primary character of change brings with it two sides. Sometimes the exchange we really like. You've got a rattle trap of a car that is not only a lemon but is yellow, and you're just delighted to be able to get rid of it, and so you exchange it for another car. Or you exchange, we use the word changing diapers. You exchange the dirty old diaper for a clean new one to everyone's relief and delight. So you get rid of the things that you don't like and you get the things that you do like. But the other side of exchanges are the things that we don't want. It's losing health and it's getting sickness, or it's losing a lifelong marriage partner and getting widowhood, or it's giving up a sense of safety and security that's been maybe forever robbed by some assailant. The character of change is exchange. Now, understanding that, we also need, if we're really going to understand what change is about, to, in a sense, agree with Heraclitus in saying that change is constant. It's always going on. It's fun to kind of analyze society and the way people in our culture think. We in our society have been greatly influenced by the camera. And cameras, when you boil down what photography can do, basically presents its pictures in two different ways. Either stills, which are snapshots, or movies. Now often, when we think of life, our understanding of life is in terms of the snapshot. So that we think of a house, or we think of a family, or we think of a car, or we think of anyone or anything as something frozen in time, a picture taken in just a very small fraction of a second. Except in reality, life is far more like a movie. Thousands, maybe tens of thousands, of snapshots all taken in succession, and any one of them only representing reality for that fraction of a second. But the truth is that it's constantly moving, constantly changing, always different. And unlike the movies, you can't play them backwards, and you can't rehearse them, you can't do them all over again, you can't clip out the parts you don't like and clip in other parts. Everything is constantly changing. So when we say, for example, that we've met here tonight, we're different than we were this morning. There are some people who are not here tonight that were here this morning. There are some people here tonight that weren't here this morning. There are some who felt kind of crummy this morning. You feel pretty good tonight. Some of you were pretty healthy this morning. You feel kind of rotten sick tonight. And all those changes constantly going on, and not just us, but all of the others that are around us, expanded out far enough, and it's the 5 billion people of the world, all changing with every second, with every click of the shutter. Add it all up, and change is great, and change is real. It's unrelenting. No stopping. It's constant. Not only is it constantly going on in terms of time, but it's constantly going on in terms of everyone. For this is one thing to be sure that there are no exemptions for. It would be, kind of okay, maybe even a little bit better, if we were able to isolate ourselves in the way we relate to all the changes that swirl around us. so that I could say, well, I'm going to do my own thing, and you can do your own thing, and it doesn't make any difference what you do, because that does not impact, that does not affect me. Except it can't be that way. It's absolutely impossible. Individual decisions can never in isolation determine life. And the longer we live, the truer we know that to be. Other people, what they say and what they do, change us, whether we would choose for it to be that way or not. Maybe one of the classic examples of those who have resisted change are the old Amish of Iowa and of Pennsylvania and a few other places in the country. They have fought it in an extraordinary way. For example, education can't go beyond the eighth grade. Automobiles are forbidden. Modern appliances are not allowed. The old Amish travel still with horse and buggy and wear clothes that are part of another era, actually another century. They end up in conflict with federal and state governments over the requirement to put those triangles in the back that say slow-moving vehicle, or to have flashers, electric ones to be sure, to warn people that here is someone that doesn't quite fit into the modern age. They have done it, and they have done it with a zeal. Except they haven't been isolated, and you know they haven't. They can't be. Even though they don't have electricity on their farms, and even though they are surprisingly efficient, even without many of the modern conveniences, the old Amish have a lucrative business going with tourists who come to see and bring their automobiles and bring their money. And they struggle the extraordinary pain and the large number of adolescents that they lose from their community every year. They say that they are not so much disappointed by the third of their teenagers who leave, but delighted by the two-thirds who stay and who seek to perpetuate what they think is an unchanging lifestyle. Now, all of this is to say that we cannot do our changing alone, and we cannot be free of the changes of other people, because everyone is in motion. We are all like an enormous river, like an enormous sea, changing, constantly moving. So it's not a choice. The choice is not whether we change or not. The choice is how we handle it. Now, track with me as we consider a little bit more about this character of change and understand for your life and for mine and for the rest of the 5 billion people who are on our earth that change flows from lots of different currents. One of those currents in the whirlpool of change is inside of us. It's the set of internal currents. Internally, we all have those distinctives that are peculiarly ours, our own individuality. Some of those things we've chosen. So things like job and marriage and what we eat and where we go and many of the options of life. Every day, every one of us faces, oh, I suppose, thousands of choices. And it's how we make those choices, whether we take this way or that way when going to school or work, or whether we eat left-handed or right-handed, all of those choices that we do make are an expression of who we are. That's our personality. However, there are many parts about the internal currents of who we are that we don't choose. They're imposed upon us, like date of birth and gender and height. Much of our genetic makeup is something that we had absolutely nothing to do with at all. And as much as we may want to, there's nothing that we can do, the scripture says, to make ourselves a cubit or a foot or an inch taller or shorter. There's nothing that we can do that will make us a day older or a year younger. Those internal currents are tough enough to cope with. And that's one of the reasons we often seek counsel. That's one of the reasons many times that we're introspective, because we are struggling ourselves with all of those currents of who we are, sometimes fighting against themselves, pulling us in one direction or another. Life would be challenging enough with just those internal currents, but there are other currents as well that swirl. There are the personal currents, not inside us, but the things which affect us as persons in our relationship with other people. Things like marriage or divorce or births or deaths or employment or family or friends. I had a psychology professor once who got off the track in the lecture that he was supposed to give when he started talking about the death earlier that year of his father. That professor, I think, was about 50 years old, and it's a vivid memory of mine, listening to him and seeing him. Although his father had been gone for a long time, it was hard for him to choke back and fight back the tears. And the most memorable line was that he said, I've had to cope. Remember, this is a someone trained in all of this, a PhD in psychology. He said, I've had to cope with the recognition that for the first time in my life, in a half century, I'm no longer anyone's son. You see, he had defined himself in terms of relationship, as we all do. And that relationship was gone. And he had to redefine himself all over again. Everyone handles these kinds of personal currents differently. In fact, sometimes as individuals, we respond differently to the same currents at different times. It can be very hard to adapt to these inside, these personal changes, the things that other people do that influence and impact us. It's difficult when we cannot have control over those things that are outside of us. But if it were that simple, it would be more simple than it really is. For in addition to these internal currents of who we are and what we choose, and the personal currents of the relationships around us are also, and I think especially at this latter part of the 20th century, the huge ebb and flow of societal changes, of these currents that are sweeping like hurricanes through our culture and changing the face of the landscape. Television, a major one, is sort of a Gulf Stream of our society. The average American watching television for 21 hours a week, an enormous influence. So that foreign wars have been and are being fought in our living room or in our den or family room every single day. So that values that we agree with and values we vehemently disagree with are instantly there, constantly being hammered at us. Changes that once we never would have heard about elsewhere in the world, we have instantly and influence the way we live, make a difference in our lives. Our society is sweeping with an incredible force, greatly affecting our personal and our internal lives. That's always been that way to some extent. The Great Depression or the Vietnam War or the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe or the escalation of medical costs and health insurance in the United States, all of these things. Let me tell you that researchers are virtually unanimous in saying that it has never been before the way it is now. Management expert Peter Drucker says that the 21st century will not begin in 10 years. It began in 1975, that the last 25 years of the 20th century really belongs in the 21st century because we have already been catapulted into these major societal changes. The waves are growing larger and they're crashing closer. And as a result, it is increasingly difficult for me as a person or us as a family or all of us together as a church or a community or even as a country, it is difficult for any of us to not be influenced and affected in major ways by all the things that are happening in the world, in these societal changes that relate to drugs and globalization and environmental pollution and political polarization and economic realignments and all of these things. Now, as these changes take place, they do so in a combination, at least in concept, of process and of point. When it's through a process that change takes place, there is forewarning. There are multiple steps which eventually bring that change. You can think of a change in your life. It may have been courtship that led to marriage, or it may have been studies that led to graduation, or it may have been career reevaluation that led to a new job. It was spread over months and maybe even years. But then we say there are also those changes that come like that, at a point in time. No forewarning. No expectation. You might, for example, compare the two different ways that presidents have come into office in the White House, especially those who have previously been vice presidents. So you might take a look at Richard Nixon and George Bush, both vice presidents of the United States, who then went out and won primaries and campaigned over a long period of time and went through the process of getting their party endorsement and then successfully winning in the general election in November, and moving from the vice presidency to the presidency process. But contrast that to Harry Truman and Lyndon Johnson, who unexpectedly, instantly, discovered that the president whom they served under was dead, and they were immediately elevated into the office of the presidency, a point in time. I think that the major changes, and especially the ones that seem to catch us by surprise, we ordinarily think of as always being point in time. The truth of it is, though, that major changes are most often, almost always, the result of a process. So rarely, in marriage or divorce or job hiring or job firing, are any of those events an instant thing that happens, even death. For the person who dies with a massive heart attack may bring great grief and great surprise to everyone that is involved, and it seems to be a sudden and unexpected thing, except medically we know that that heart attack has been a building perhaps since birth, all through life, from lifestyle, from genetics, all of those things, that it too is the culmination of a process. The difference is that sometimes we see the process, sometimes we don't see that process at work, but usually the process is always there. But one thing that we can do to cope with change and even manage change is to see and to understand that process. And when we're aware then of what's going on in our bodies or in our marriages or in our church or in our community or our families or any of the other institutions or our society, then we are far less likely to be taken by surprise, and we are far in a far better and stronger position to impact that process in ways that will affect the outcome. Now, all of that introductory stuff said, where's God in all of this? Does he know and does he care? Does he have power or is he impotent? Is God also being swept along by the huge changes that are taking place in our world? Has he caught up with the drug cartel or with OPEC or the collapse of communism or globalization or the speed of communication? Does he know all that's going on? And is he changing to keep up with modern times and with what's happening in our lives? Well, the Bible is quite clear about all of that, telling us that, in fact, God does not change. 1 Samuel 15:29 declares that God does not lie or change his mind, for he is not a man that he should change his mind. Or in Malachi 3:6, the straight-out declaration, I, the Lord, do not change. And the marvelous words of James 1:17, that every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows. Our Bible teaches us that God is sovereign, that he is therefore in ultimate control of every factor of everyone and everywhere and every time, of every change, that he knows everything in advance, and that he is in complete control. Now, in some ways, intellectually, that can unsettle us, for we can wonder how the world can be going the way it is if, in fact, God is really in control. But his declaration to us that he is in control and that he is sovereign and does not change is not intended to unsettle us, but rather to assure us that even the most diverse and difficult and extraordinary of circumstances and changes can be brought around to God's good ends, and that he guarantees from the beginning that the end will be good and that the end will be right. Far more important than our intellectual questioning is what is our response to who God is in all the fluctuations of change that transpire around us. And it is the recognition that who God is and that he doesn't change calls us to responsibility and to trust. Responsibility in that we obey God and we become his agents of change, that we become his representatives, particularly at what has to be one of the most monumental eras of all of history in which we live, and that he be well represented by us, obeying a God who knows what's going on. But it's also trust, that whether we are caught in the current of that which is on the inside or closely on the outside or the huge tidal waves of societal change, or whether we're in a whirlpool where they all seem to slush together, that we can trust him. Whether it's in some extraordinary happiness or pleasure, or whether it's in an unspeakable pain and disappointment, that God is trustworthy, that he does not change, that he is sovereign, that we may trust him always. Well, all of this, I know, sounds kind of theoretical, the way introductory talks are supposed to be. We say, yeah, but change is not a theoretical thing to me. Change for me is what happened at work last week. Change for me is what my family's going through this month. Change for me is what I think the doctor's going to say on Monday morning. Change for me is my dreams. Change for me is my hopes. Change for me is a better tomorrow. Change for me is all of these realities. Sometimes it seems as if everything is changing. The realities of change are that God gives to us an extraordinary opportunity. An extraordinary opportunity to live for Him and trust Him through that change. Living and changing and trusting and obeying. A couple weeks ago, our family was on vacation in Florida, and we made what, of course, is an essential pilgrimage to Disney World. And Disney World, although I've been a lot of places in this globe, is, I've got to tell you, one of my favorite places to go. I like it there. You know, I just accept that as part of who I am on the inside. And, it was really fun. We went to the MGM studios, and we went in there and traveled around and went to this place where they put on a TV show right there on the spot. And 1,000 people, and they pick people from the audience for the different roles. I mean, who do you think they pick first? You got me. I mean, that's one of the happiest moments of my life. And, it took me in there to read the news and dress me up in all of their clothes and all of the, it was swell. Our son Jeff was picked to be on Gilligan's Island as the millionaire, which I wish really were true. But anyway, after being at MGM Studios, we went over to the Magic Kingdom. And I go, on the roller coasters and all the wild things that you're supposed to do. But I have a favorite ride at Disney World, and I've been there lots of times. And there's a couple of reasons I like it, one of which is there's never a line, which probably says something about my choices in comparison to everybody else's. But it is called the Carousel of Progress. Maybe you've been there. And what it is a building where on the outside of it, there are seats in like little theaters, and then in the inside is a whole set of scenes, and they have like mannequins that with Disney's genius are able to talk and to move around. And you go through a sequence that begins in the 1800s. It's in a home with a family, a home where they're excited about some of the new changes that are coming, that now it's possible to have gas lanterns out on the streets. And it's possible to have modern-day printing presses that can get us the news in just a few days or a few weeks' time. And then you move up a generation. And then there's a whole group of people that are excited about the progress that change has brought. They're talking about having indoor plumbing and things like telephones and electricity. And you move scene by scene, family by family, through the generations up to modern times where there's a big screen television in the family room and a microwave oven in the kitchen and a computer in the study. And throughout all of the scenes, the same song is sung. Over and over they sing, "Now is the time. Now is the best time. Now is the best time of your life. Life is a prize. Live every minute. Open your eyes and watch how you win it. Yesterday's memories may sparkle and gleam. Tomorrow is still a dream. Right here and now, you've got it made. The world is marching and you are in the parade. Now is the time. Now is the best time. Be it a time of joy or strife, there's so much to cheer for. Be glad you're here, for it's the best time of your life." Without God, that simply is not true. For when the painful and difficult changes come, I don't hear anyone saying, "It's the best time of my life." But with Him, we can face that change. On the inside, in our personal relationships around us, and in the flood of all that's happening in our world. And with Jesus Christ, I think we genuinely can sing. Be it strife or joy, there's so much to cheer for. Be glad you're here, for it's the best time of your life. Father, for all of us and the changes that we face, It is the best time of our lives, when our lives belong to you. For you are the one, through strife or joy, through changes great or small, who is faithful to us. We are grateful for your great faithfulness, and we pray that we may trust you and be trustworthy. In Jesus' name, amen.